Before I get started today, I wanted to give a big shout out to Jeannie Colwin Coaching. Jeannie is a stress and TMS coach based in LA, the best coast. Her work involves not only a specialized focus on TMS, but also helping clients transform important aspects of life that feel stuck or overwhelming. Think career, relationships, weight issues, confidence, purpose, life stressors, you name it. You're going to find her compassionate, action-oriented, results-driven, all the things that you need in a coach to create meaningful change. She's got a holistic approach, and it's going to help you make the changes that are important to you. You will walk away feeling empowered to continue to create the life that you want. One of the many things that make Jeannie a terrific coach is she's been in the trenches. Like, she's been there. She's done all this stuff. She overcame fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. It left her physically and mentally depleted. Simply put, she gets it because she's been there. She healed herself completely. Now she's focused on delivering fast results to her clients through a one-on-one coaching program. The best part about working with Jeannie is that she takes the stress out of the process. You're going to have a customized and simple plan with tools and strategies that align with your individual lifestyle. So not a cookie-cutter approach. This is for you. I encourage you to book a free 45-minute call with her about this one-on-one coaching program so you can fast-track results. I've heard from a couple of listeners that have reached out to her and worked with her, and they say great things. If you work with Jeannie, you're going to embark on a transformative path where obstacles are overcome and breakthroughs become the norm. Go to jeanniecolwin.com. That's JeannieKulwin.com to book your free call today. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. It is September the 7th. My name is Eddie Lindenstein. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We're going to hop in the Wayback Machine. Before we do that, though, let me give a shout out to the patrons of the podcast. If you're interested in supporting the show, go to patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. Let me give a shout out to Teresa, Albert, Jeff, Julie, Deborah, Daniel, Emily, Elise, Dominic, and John, Jason, Mindy, Irina, Kelly, Tony, Michael, Mike, Christina, Julie, Brian, Sarah, Arnie, and Barb. Thank you all so much for continuing to support this podcast every single week. I very much appreciate it. It's what helps keep this thing available for everybody. This is one of my favorite interviews ever. November 14th, 2018, I did an interview with Dr. Margaret Chan, and she's phenomenal. This is quite the interview. I think it's like an hour and 11 minutes or something like that. So it's going to be cool to go back and kind of hear the length on that. But Dr. Chan does amazing work in this field. You may be familiar with her already. So let's check that out. Next week, I'm going to be out of the country. So if I can get together an episode before I leave, then you'll get one. Otherwise, you're going to get a week off. So we'll just see kind of how it plays. And I'm sure I'll have some stories for you when I get back. So without further ado, here is Dr. Margaret Chan out of New Jersey and I from almost 5 years ago. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein, and today I come to you with another treat. Dr. Margaret Chan from Central Jersey. She's right down by Rutgers University. How are you, Dr. Chan?
I'm doing great.
So I'm so happy that we were able to get connected. You know, your name is one of the ones that there's, it seems like there's some of the, I don't know if psychology celebrity is the right term, but you're certainly one of the names that I feel like I hear come up a lot, whether it's in All the Rage or even from people that just rave about you on some of these TMS forums and TMS Facebook pages. So you have quite the name out there.
Well, thank you. I didn't realize I had such a presence.
And we'll get into that. It's actually, I had mentioned that a little bit later in the show, we're going to do some questions from one of the Facebook pages. And there was, I feel like there was three or four either of people that have worked with you or do work with you that mentioned that they do. And it was so there may be some familiar names as we roll through this. So, you know, I guess let's start with your, you know, with your background and your schooling and kind of what some of your specialty is, because you're, you know, you're fully known as
Dr. Margaret Chan for TMS, and when I go on your website, it says specializing in tension myositis syndrome and mind-body disorders. You know, kind of tell me, how did you get into psychology and then also into specifically into mind-body disorders? What led you there?
Right. So in terms of my background, it's, you know, it's a PhD, it's in clinical psychology. And how I got into it was, it kind of started off with trauma psychology. When I was in graduate school, I had studied child trauma. So that's looking at neglect, abuse, sexual traumas, violence, all sorts of interpersonal dynamics that would lead to that. So also looking at anger specifically that might drive that dynamic within the child's household and transgenerationally. So a lot of my research back in graduate school was looking at anger, violence, and how that manifested in the child. So at that time, I was also looking at alexithymia, which is the inability to express emotions because the trauma was severe. So alexithymia would be simply defined as the inability to have words for feelings. So like three stages, inability to even recognize you have a feeling, and then the ability to identify the words for it. And then latter would be the inability to express it. And then from that, also looking at resilience, that that most children, and I would say adults as well, that we may go through hard times. It doesn't have to be trauma, sort of a clinical significance of trauma. But most of us have resilience, meaning that we have just one adult figure or one teacher that believed in us, then that could make a remarkable difference in someone's life. I mean, there are personality factors as well with children, you know, temperament, sort of cognitive styles, learning. So all those things matter into how someone behaves and sort of relate as they get older. So with TMS, it was almost a shoo-in. So by the time I had graduated graduate school and got my PhD, there was then rotations and kind of like how it is with physicians, you have a residency. And in my residency in my internship, I got to do a family medicine track and really got connected with Dr. Paul Guatz and his preceptor there, Marianne Stewart, who introduced me to Dr. John Sarno's work. And it was such a shoo-in because I was already working with children and trauma and oftentimes psychosomatic manifestations of the trauma. And from there, just really working with patients with fibromyalgia, which is, as you would know, is musculoskeletal disease, you know, back pain, migraines, carpal tunnel, chronic fatigue syndrome. So there was many, you know, now Dr. Sarno would say those were TMS equivalents were being manifested with some of the patients I saw at family medicine at that time. And it was just sort of serendipitous that the people that I worked with was also affiliated and worked with Dr. Sarno. And so that sort of just became an amazing shoo-in and a connection. And then from there, I was trained under Dr. Arlene Feinblatt, who was just across the bridge, New Jersey, New York. And just met up with her. Her office is like across from the Empire State Building. It was very easy to find her. She was very gracious and got a lot of my initial psychosomatic cases or TMS cases supervised with her. And so there was a couple years there, probably more so. We became really good friends as well. Just sort of talking about TMS and the therapy aspect, the unconscious aspect, the personality aspect. And so that really informed my TMS initial beginnings. So that's sort of the background in terms of getting into TMS.
So you mentioned that so pre being introduced to Dr. Sarno's work, you were already doing some work with some patients with psychosomatic responses.
Yeah,
right?
Little did I know that Dr. Sarno was, you know, for him, you know, healing back pain was this all encompassing of psychosomatic medicine.
What were some of the more, because I mean, when you were treating patients like pre Sarno, before you knew about TMS or knew about his work, I guess were some of the symptoms or some of the things that people were reporting to you, was it the same as it was after that, or were they maybe not as severe? Because I think, like, I've talked to therapists before, and not necessarily on this show, but I was lucky enough when I went searching for one that he had heard of Sarno. He wasn't a TMS therapist, but he'd somebody that read the book, totally aligned with how he believed and what he believed. But I know that there are therapists that aren't necessarily on board with that whole theory. And so were you seeing people that had a fibromyalgia and disc problems and all these, you know, all these things that Sarno writes about his books before you even discovered Sarno's work?
I mean, were I treating patients that were Dr. Sarno patients?
No. Did you come across patients before you found John Sarno's work that had fibromyalgia or had different types of issues? Like, were people coming to you already?
Right, exactly. So I was already seeing patients that were having mind-body disorders, for sure. And that was before I connected with Dr. Sarno's, you know, work on tension myositis syndrome. And I'll definitely talk about that some more in terms of, say, psychosomatic medicine in general versus, say, Dr. Sarno's theory, and why that is actually a, what he did, I think, deserves like a Nobel Peace Prize. Yeah. Because he really bridged the gap, I would say, and it continues to be a gap for, say, psychological medicine and physiological medicine.
Definitely. I can think of, you know, if I went back and took this book or even talked about the theory to any of the 24 doctors or so that I saw before I finally got to one that said, hey, consider what's going on in your life, as opposed to kind of what's going on in your body, you know, like, actually taking more of a mind body approach, I feel like I'd be laughed out of the building by a lot of them. It's a heartache, because there's probably a lot of people out there. Well, I know there's a lot of people out there that are sort of unnecessarily suffering over this. So, think back, I guess, like, cause when we talked a week or so ago before, you know, before recording this podcast, obviously we started to get into a discussion about, the ACE study. And I kind of want to start there, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study that was done in the 1990s, that and there's some statistics given in that All the Rage movie that essentially if there's a score of a 7 or greater, predisposes you to a lot of problems. So I guess talk about, because there are a lot of people that listen to this show that that did have significant childhood trauma, and then there's a lot like me that did not. And so I want to talk to both of those crowds with you for a bit. Talk about the ACE study. What sort of correlations you've seen in patients? Is it reversible? Does it matter? You know, kind of that kind of stuff.
I mean, short answer, I mean, the ACE study was pivotal in bridging, I would say, mind body. It was just, I think I had shared with you that I wish that the medical world would just simply have that questionnaire on their intake form next to the insurance and the HIPAA consent form. Or through their little iPads, now that we, that's sort of what we use in most waiting rooms now. It definitely showed how just by having, I think it was like 4 or more items, that your chances for cardiovascular diseases, obesity, hypertension, like increases by like 3 or 4 times the amount, compared to someone with an ACE of like 4 or lower. And I think that in terms of TMS work, I definitely see both populations, people with trauma, people without. And so what I was saying earlier in terms of my background of, say, trauma child psychology and looking at how it manifests psychosomatically is that it's not just trauma. It's TMS can be manifested because of TMS personality. And I think that was the missing link for me. Which you know, why Dr. Sarno's work fascinated me was this characterological work. And I often say to patients, you know, it's not that I'm just decreasing your TMS symptoms or your pain symptoms. It's really looking at your TMS personality profile, that you could just have, say, load high on perfectionism and goodism, and that will sort of stir up this all these, say, stress hormones and neurotransmitters that kind of sort of hyperfire or hypofire in certain people's systems that can create TMS pain or works for some people, you know, Sarno's tension myositis, but also tension myoneural. So sometimes it's, you know, a muscular situation. Sometimes it's, say, like neurological situation. So it doesn't have to be, you know, an ACE of 7 or more to have TMS. You can have TMS with an ACE of 1 because your TMS personality loading, so to speak, is just off the charts. When I say loading, like perfectionism, goodism, dependency, hostility, low self-esteem, those personality factors that Dr. Sarno talks about.
And I think that that's there's going to be a question from one of the people on the Facebook page that's we're going to talk a little bit more in depth about his specific question a little bit later. But I guess for the people that you see and the people that you treat, you know, what's the percentage of people that have these high A scores versus have low A scores or very low A scores? Is it, you know, 70% people with high and 30% people with low, or is it split more evenly than that?
You know, I would say like a quarter of my patients, I would say lower than a third, a quarter of my patients definitely would fit, you know, PTSD, you know, full-blown clinical significance for trauma. And that sort of repressed rage, guilt, and shame is a big factor into your TMS. It's sort of like a lot of authors wrote about, you know, Vandercook, you know, body keeps a score, the body remembers. I mean, there's so many authors that have written about how trauma is stored like a muscle memory in one's body. And then I would say, like, the majority of the patients, like 75%, is personality factors, where they were goodist and perfectionist to begin with. I mean, sort of just by nature. So they were sort of, you can say, born that way, that they... It was important for them to be people pleasers or to do work or to be competitive. That was always there. Of course, nurture, say parenting styles or their geographic area, their peers would sort of either increase that or decrease that. So sometimes TMS manifests in high school. For some people, it's college, and for others, it's when they have their first child, and for others, it's when they have a career change, and for others, it's when they retire, when they're about to broach retirement. So sort of that threshold for when TMS hits is different for many. It could be at any milestone or any sort of, as I would say, sort of developmental stages in one's life.
Yeah, it's interesting that Dr. Sarno talks about in his book specifically, like, the age of responsibility. Because for me, like, as I thought back, like, you know, I had symptoms going back pretty far, but really, like, the bottom fell out at 30 years old, like, right when he says it starts.
Yeah, you wouldn't be the only one. It's, you know, it's crisis time.
Totally. And I, like, at the time, my daughter was 2 years old, you know, like 2 year olds, they start to, like, they get these, like, personalities, right? And I let Nicole Sachs talks a lot about some of her struggles with motherhood, and a lot of that probably contributed pretty heavily to what was going on. And it's really just being able to admit, because I remember, like, I would tell my therapist, it took me essentially like 6 months of therapy work with my doctor or my therapist for me to be able to say, my daughter stresses me out sometimes. Like, it took 6 months to do that.
Right. I mean, you're excited and rageful at the same time.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah, just and is causing a major disruption in your life.
You know, I'm interested too, because Dr. Schechter and I, one thing that we brought up that wasn't even planned going into it, but he started talking about UCLA and we started talking about a couple of collegiate athletes, where he was saying that, you know, he gave examples. One of them was like, maybe there's like a gymnast, for instance, that's been doing this since they were a little kid and their parents kind of pushed them into practice and stuff. And then they kind of get to this point where they're just like, I don't really want to do it anymore, but they just can't bring themselves to say it. And then suddenly they get a knee injury and, you know, the doctor can't find anything wrong. But as a parent, like, you can't push your kid with a knee injury to keep doing gymnastics, right? So maybe that's a way of getting out of it. You're close to Rutgers University. Are there collegiate athletes? I mean, you don't have to give names, obviously, or anything that would, you know, broach that confidence. But are there, you know, maybe collegiate level athletes that are, you know, surefire TMS cases that you've been able to eradicate symptoms with?
Absolutely. And I would say, not just collegiate athletes, but just athletes in general. And I don't want to name the sport, the level, but, you know, I've definitely seen athletes nationally and internationally because of, you know, you asked me the percentage of patients that have trauma versus no trauma or no clinical significance of trauma. I could say that, like, I could confidently say that almost a good half of my patients are had an athletic history. So if I see someone who's in their 50s, they were, say, pro baseball players in their teens and 20s or something like that. Yeah. So athleticism, any history with sports, I mean, you know, Dr. Sarno being in sports rehabilitation is a big part of TMS.
There was a, there's someone that I follow on Instagram. She's a pretty well-known, like, national level weightlifter. And there was a post that she had a week or maybe 2 weeks ago where she said that she woke up and suddenly, like, her glutes stopped firing and her hamstrings stopped firing and all this kind of stuff. And I, you know, there was a lot of, this person has, you know, she's got 50,000 followers or 100,000 followers or something crazy like that. And I was looking at the comments and it was, you know, did you try doing this stretch? Did you try going to see this chiropractor? Did you try this supplement? And I'm looking at it and I'm like, no, like, TMS. And I commented, hey, you know, I would recommend this book. And if you're interested, like, you can mess it. You know, I didn't hear from her. But it certainly seems prevalent out there. And I think as an athlete, especially like in an iron sport, like I'm in Olympic style weightlifting, that it's tough. It's like the expectation would be, okay, you lift heavy weights a lot, so you're going to have aches and pains, but certainly not, you know, chronic spasming like over and over and over, right? That's a tough thing to.
I'm so glad you brought up this aspects of sports and TMS, because I can't tell you, if I have to name off all the sort of genres or sports, I mean, they come, you know, I would see people that were like baseball, footy, soccer players, football, and, you know, like yourself, bodybuilders, or they're in the bodybuilding world, both male, females, tennis players, I'm like probably missed. Those are just, you know, current sports that I'm sort of shooting off from the top of my head there. And it's really, for me, it's a nice opportunity to see them during training. So say bodybuilding. I mean, just seeing someone in the transformation of their body just, I would say, 8 months before game day or their competition day is just amazing. That they can squat, I don't know, 5 plates and still think that they have a back problem. And then 1 week they could be on the floor spazzing and back pain, and the next week they'll be fine. And had they not understood or was in TMS therapy or had a TMS support network, that one would think that there was something medically wrong with them. But the anxiety and the pressure and the discipline that goes into bodybuilding and prepare for that, the nutrition, the I mean, there's I'm sure there's terminologies I'm not using right here that goes into getting rid of stubborn fat and then eating a lot and then not eating right before is things that could enrage the id, because it goes against your pleasure principle. And so it's sort of a tough balance, but the balance is struck for whoever's coming to see me. What is it that their wish fulfillment is? They have to understand what they're fighting and what it is that they're trying to accomplish there without upsetting their unconscious self.
I think that I'm going to come back to that in a second. When Steve Ozanich and I interviewed him earlier this year, maybe 9 or 10 months ago, and I don't think it made it on the interview. I think it was just us sort of shooting the breeze afterwards. We were both talking about how at the time that we were told that we had weak abs and that was the cause of all of our pain, we were squatting 300 pounds, 350 pounds. Like, yeah. Just how absurd that it sounded, you know what I mean? Yeah. So it's funny that you brought up that example specifically. The subconscious part of the brain, I think this is where so many people get hung up, and I talk to like my neighbors about this kind of stuff, and I talk to people that I know and friends of mine and stuff like that, and I think that the conversation sometimes when they have a pain or when I describe a pain, that they kind of take the simplistic question of what am I stressed about? And the problem with TMS is that it's so much like psychosomatic. I think some people think, okay, like maybe my shoulder hurts and it's because my kids stress me out or my job stresses me out, but it's deeper than that. So talk about the subconscious side, the id side. Like, I can tell that's like a big fiery passion of yours, and I think it's probably the biggest thing that people don't understand, that are stuck in this wheel of like, do I have TMS? Do I not have TMS? Do I have TMS? Do I not have TMS? Is that critical subconscious id part of it?
So I mean, it's, thank you so much for asking that question. It's I think this is such a trademark of Dr. Sarno that I think really sort of is the perfect marriage between, say, Freud and like the medical field. and talking about the unconscious rage and, you know, how that is important to address versus, say, what am I stressed about? So you're looking at, say, what are my cognitive thought patterns to dealing with daily stress? Do I think about it differently in terms of my boss, and maybe think about people's strength, and maybe having a more positive approach, more adaptive thinking styles would get rid of my stress level. And if my stress level goes down, then my TMS pain will be gone. I think for many people that could definitely help. But I think by the time someone is on the floor spazzing and their back has gone out, or they're having severe migraines or IBS or, you know, chronic fatigue or any of those very sort of severe TMS equivalents. And, you know, for some people, they might just call out of work for a few days. But you talk about TMS patients that are considering short-term disability because it's so crippling. I would say a deeper look into the unconscious mind is necessary, and not just look at stress levels. So, so sometimes the best way for me to answer it is to use movies and art to describe what I'm saying. And I'm a big fan of Breaking Bad.
It's one of my favorite shows. Yeah.
Yeah. If anyone hasn't watched it, I don't want to do any spoilers here, but Walter White would be someone that I would say that his lung cancer has saved him from TMS. because you got this high school chemistry teacher who is, you know, has a son with MS, and he's such a goodist, you know, he's just trying to be the best, you know, father and chemistry teacher that he can, but yet he's disgruntled. And when lung cancer finally hit, oh boy, you know, he is just so resentful that he got screwed over yet again. And so you see that transformation of his id, I would say, who I would say is Heisenberg, comes out. And I'm not saying that Breaking Bad is what we all are, but essentially I would say tapping into the unconscious mind is kind of like Breaking Bad. And I guess I'm talking about the goodest for the people who load highest on the goodest realm of things, where they do everything for other people, but really they're sitting on a mountain of resentment and rage and sort of lack of appreciation from other people for what they have done. It's almost like this covert narcissism in you that has gotten you so resentful for the lack of recognition, appreciation that you deserve or you feel that you deserve. So that would be like a common one in terms of unconscious rage. It's like you are seemingly helpful, you know, a good teacher, a good trainer, and yet you're sitting on a mountain full of resentment because, like Walter White, you didn't get the recognition that you've always wanted. But looking at Breaking Bad, there was always evidence that it was there. And now I get into specific scenes, but you can see how that Heisenberg in him was there before. When they show clips of him prior to marriage, like I say, his previous girlfriends, and how he lost out on certain things and certain opportunities.
God,
so that's a way of answering.
Yeah, I was going to say
that would be like the best example.
It's one of my wife's favorite shows, and I text her and I said, "Dr. Chan is talking about Breaking Bad." So it's so perfect that you brought it up.
You know, there's a Heisenberg in all of us, but yeah, there's something about the id. When you think about it in terms of the pleasure principle, it is selfish. It cares about no other. It wants what it wants now. I mean, you know, a patient once told me, hey, the best way to remember what the id is in the word kid. So sometimes in therapy, I will always address, hey, it's not just your stress level. What part of your little boy or your little girl are you neglecting? What was it that she or he always wanted? So to tie it back to Dr. Sarno in terms of unconscious stuff, it would be looking at the six basic needs. Okay, so like no matter, I always say this is like the foundation or the biblical part of Dr. Sarno would be the six basic needs, the race-soothe ratio, the TMS personality. Can't get away from those basics or those tenets. Six basic needs. It's like, well, if those needs aren't met on some adequate, good enough level, you're going to have some level of TMS manifestation. What, you know, the need to be perfect. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, what are the six basic needs?
Okay, so it's like pop quiz for me, so I hope I remember all this. I think it was the need to be perfect, the need to be liked, the need to be taken care of. The need to be soothed, the need to feel invincible, and the need to feel immortal. So it's kind of like this aging is enraging one. That's the last item. And what I would say what's most important, if I would say if anyone is getting into TMS, I would say memorize those six basic needs and sort of evaluate how which one of those is really being neglected or not met.
So one thing, and to me, this ties back to earlier when you were talking, you know, we were talking about stress levels, right? And so if we reduce the stress in our lives or we, you know, we reduce the stress in our lives that our TMS should go away. And it just doesn't work like that.
Right.
Like,
I mean, Walter White could, you know, decrease his stress level as being a chemistry teacher or have a better approach of, let's say, accepting his lung cancer. But that wasn't going to do it for him. That's what I'm trying to illustrate, like. No amount of stress management and anger management was going to help address that without him tapping into his id, which was ultimately Heisenberg.
So when we tie that concept back, like the idea of like the unmet needs, like let's just take perfectionism for instance, and or even being immortal, right? Like nobody's immortal. So being able to like face our own mortality or imperfectionism, like if you're not perfect and you can't change that, how can you reconcile that to make symptoms go away?
If you're not perfect and you have this insatiable appetite or you have this impossible standard, if you can't meet an impossible standard, how can you get rid of your TMS? Is that what you're asking?
Correct. Because if that's the child need that is not being met, being perfect, right. Then how do you reconcile it?
Right. So, you know, part of this is, you know, let's say that the need to be liked is, a lot of this is rooted in unfinished business. It's like what they didn't get when they were a child. So for Walter White, he was totally dissed when he didn't get that certain patent that he thought he, you know, the company owed him or something. So he was never going to get that opportunity back. You know, unfinished business or an impossible standard is what I have to deal with on a, you know, daily basis with TMS patients. You have unfinished business with a loved one, but that person died. You have a perfect standard that you can't meet. How do you reach resolution? And oftentimes I would start going to Kristen Neff's work, who's another amazing psychologist and researcher on self-compassion. And oftentimes I talk to, and I'll borrow work from other researchers, and I would say self-compassion is such a key element in sort of talking to the child. So if the superego is the parent in this, and you have this harsh, overly critical parent, all you do is to either dismiss the child or belittle the child, and of course, deep down inside, you can break the child. The child gets enraged and disgruntled, or just say depressed. So, self-compassion is that what I would say. One sort of a understanding to say either you need to. We need to really look at what you're setting up for yourself, because you're really setting yourself up for failure, and you're not looking at all the other things that really show your true colors. So it's not about lowering the bar or lowering expectations. It's that it's like you're not even having an accurate view of yourself. You just set up this whole other distraction. Let's say perfectionism is a distraction. Like, you set up this impossible goal. Like, for me, I don't know, impossible goal. Goals. Like, I'm not going to be a Olympic figure skater anytime soon. I've already passed my prime on that. I was never trained to do anything like that. So one would have to sort of look at, why did you form that goal? It's almost like you formed something. Was it a distraction? Was it unfinished business? Like, where did it come from? So sort of let's understand why that goal was set up in the first place. That, and then looking at that from a self-compassionate point of view as to what, in setting up that goal, what were you hoping to meet emotionally? Like, what emotional need did you think would fulfill you if you actually met those goals? So if I became a figure skater and I got a gold medal, is that going to answer all my problems? Will I then feel ultimately loved, special? Like, is that going to knock off, like, the first two needs, the first two basic needs? And so the conversation becomes, let's talk about a time when you did achieve something. How long did that last? And so we get into this conversation where it's insatiable. So that's where we talk about self-compassion and more compassionate or accurate goals that are more satiable than insatiable.
Definitely. And it makes me think of long before I found anything with Sarno, almost a year before, where when I talked about like the bottom really falling out, I had certain, actually there's a collegiate athlete that I talk to on Facebook pretty regularly who found me, and he's got TMS, right? And one of the things that we talk about, because he was telling me that he, you know, as his pain has started, or his pain has revved up, like he's not lifting weights the way that he wants, and he's watching his body change, and it's, you know, giving him a bad opinion of himself. And I told him, like, look, man, I went as far as like having shoulder surgery, and I was out of the weight room for 5 months rehabbing after the surgery, which now looking back, I feel like maybe that was more of a TMS thing, because I felt pretty good by the time I went into surgery, but I was being pointed at this imaging that said, you need to have this corrected, even though I felt pretty good. I was pretty functional. And the week that I was to be medically cleared for all activity, like sciatica starts and back spasms start. But one of the things that I told him I had been dealing with was, I dropped 25 or 30 pounds in mass. And so watching my body change, like, it was really, really hard. And I understand what it is that you're saying. And I remember, like, I was in debilitating pain for 6 or 7 weeks. And then I was under a lot of pressure at work, and then I closed a really big contract for a customer. And I remember, like, literally that same day, an hour later or something like that, my pain completely vanished. It like just washed away. It was like all that blood came right back to all that tissue, and I was fine. And I just thought, like, this is so weird. Like, what was it that happened? Did I move my back the right way and the nerves were fine or something like that? And then a week and a half later or something, when my new quota started for the month as a salesperson, all the pain came back like a, you know, like it never had left. And, you know, for me, I think like perfectionism and being good and being reliable and kind of all these things for me, like that's me. I fall into the personality trait. I don't fall into the, you know, into the category of the childhood trauma, but it's nice to hear that I'm in the camp with 75% of people.
No, absolutely. And, you know, the therapy was sort of look at like, where did that super parent come from? You know, where did that harsh critic come from? Like, did you think that tough love or, you know, I had to sort of just look this up the other day, you know, that famous football coach, Vince Lombardi, like, winning isn't everything. Winning is the only thing. And it's like, wow, if you're going to live like that, and if winning is the only thing, then that means everything else is just not worth it or not worth living for. Yep. So the alternative is just pretty much a sort of this death principle. If winning is the only thing. And I think if you have such an impossible standard where winning is the only thing, I mean, that's really sad and super harsh. So this is where taking that time, and a lot of bulk of the work, if it's not a trauma model, is to really look at the characteristic trait of perfectionism. Where did that harsh parental voice come from? And when you were a child, was that, people in general struggling with TMS personality, what gain did you get? Like, where did you think that by doing that sort of, say, Vince Lombardi type of coaching style get you? Like, did it work for you as a child? And when did it work? When did it not work? And why are you still holding on to that model where winning is everything? Winning is the only thing.
Right.
And so this is where I talk about self-compassion and also understanding where it comes from and sort of coming up with a new or a compromised reparenting model.
You know, one of the Sarno theories that I feel like is, because one thing that I've always kind of struggled with, especially in seeing people give other people advice, so it'd be nice to have this cleared up by an expert, is in Sarno's books, one of the things, I think it's in the Mind-Body Prescription, it might be in The Divided Mind, one of his later books, but he mentions some of the tips that he's had many patients who talk to their brain and literally like yell at their brain for pulling such a bad trick on them. So to me, like when I think of that, I think of yelling at the kid inside of you. Whereas, you know, you're talking about compassion and things like that. So what, you know, I guess what is the right thing to do? Or is that even what Sarno meant when he says to yell at your brain?
You know, I would say that, you know, that question you're asking, I'm so glad you're asking it because it's like one of my top questions that patients ask me all the time. It's like, do I yell at my brain and tell it to knock it off or, you know, put one foot in front of the other, keep walking because there's nothing wrong with me. So why don't I just hike up that mountain like, you know, there's nothing physically wrong. And I would say, you know, sometimes when TMS gives you a signal, you need to listen to it. It doesn't mean to succumb to it, but I would say when TMS strikes or you have an episode or you're completely paralyzed by it, maybe you need to look at why that signal is happening. I would say rewind that security tape. What happened? So you could yell at it, but essentially if you think of a parent yelling at a child who is having school refusal, doesn't want to go to school, and is faking. A child doesn't know they're faking. I mean, first of all, they're really having a fever. They don't want to go to school at all. That they literally have a fever, and it's just like, wow, you really don't want to school. You have a whole fever right now. So, of course, you could just treat the fever as a fever, or you can say, what is it about school that you don't want to go to? So you can yell at the child, say, I don't care, you don't really have a fever, go to school anyway. So here's the thing with, you know, TMS. It's not this notion that it's just all in your head. There really is a physiological pain response that is happening, just like that child really is having a fever. So in terms of yelling at the brain, I don't find it as effective, because ultimately you're dismissing the what the emotional cry out for help is. So you could push through and say, one foot in front of the other, you're going to school. I think for some kids, that might work. But I would say that most TMS patients, because they are already harsh on themselves, for me to then enforce that they yell at their brain basically collapses them or puts them in a more resistant state in terms of their unconscious rage. It makes them almost angrier. And so this is why I think sometimes TMS pain becomes chronic. It kind of has this like this stubborn streak. It doesn't go away because you never did address the emotional need. You didn't see that TMS signal as a cry out for help. You told it to keep on, you know, one foot in front of the other. So sometimes soldiering on works if you're coddling the pain too much, and sometimes soldiering on doesn't work because you need to address the emotional cry out for help.
So far that last 4 minutes, maybe aside from the Breaking Bad part, was been my favorite part so far. I think that was all so beautifully put. I think, like, because that's one thing that I've always had that I had trouble with, like in reading Sarno's books, like yelling at your brain and being, you know, being angry with the child inside of you. But I kept thinking, like, okay, but isn't that kind of what got me into this in the first place? You know
exactly.
What I mean?
Exactly.
Is that really going, you know, is that, are more exclamation points really going to make the problem go away? So it sounds like be kind to yourself is really a better message. And probably.
And no matter what, you have to address what is the emotional cry out for help? What is the unfinished business? Like, maybe we need to say, why is that child in such a sick state that they're so scared to go to school, or, you know, whatever the adult analogy to that would be.
I think that's awesome. Before I get into these questions from some of the listeners, I wanted to ask too, and I know, like, you know, one of the TMS sins of people that are trying to heal is this idea of like putting a time limit on yourself or whatever. But like, generally speaking, people that have chronic pain, whether it's, you know, 6 months or whether it's 20 years, like, what do you tend to find in the personality trait pool versus the high A score pool, so the 75 versus the 25, in terms of like length of time and what they need to do in order to, like, what do they need to understand to heal? And what's I don't want to say a realistic expectation in terms of time to get better, but I guess, like, is this something that can be extinguished fast with the book cure that seems like mythology? Or for most people, is it, this is going to be probably a longer process with a waxing and waning and probably not much of a linear progression to get out of pain? I guess, what's your thought on, you know, length of time and that kind of thing?
So I hear a few questions there. One is the length of time, and also what are some of the top factors that facilitate that time of recovery? So I would say that by the time patients come to me, none of them are book cures. And so they come to me, they already feel like a failure because they're like, oh, Dr. Sarno says that 95% of his patients are cured by the book and 5% of the people need therapy. So I'm one of those 5% that is clearly a book failure. And I say, that's okay, because you're actually part of the 100% that I see.
Right, right, right.
So for me, I don't see that 95%. Although I should say that a lot of people had the book here and then, you know, life events happen and then the TMS episode strikes again. So they couldn't quite put that pattern together as to why that happened. So in terms of length of time, and I know that's just such a, you know, as a psychologist, I hate that question because, you know, the psychologist stereotypically says, well, it depends. But I will give you the short answer is that I typically see patients weekly for about a year because it's not like how do I cure a lifetime of a template in which you functioned off of that was formed from childhood that didn't work for you for decades usually? And then you want me to turn that all around in 6 to 8 sessions? I'm sorry, that's really hard to do.
Right.
So sometimes many times I don't necessarily need a year. I always say, like on my website, I would say, you know, beginning, middle, and end of therapy. So you can say, like, the beginning, it's like the first 3-4 months, the middle phase is like the, you know, the next 4, and then the end phase is another 3-4. And I would say like the beginning of treatment is almost like kind of like this interview right now. It's sort of psychoeducation, it's sort of reinforcement of TMS principles, identification of, oh, see that right there is an example of your id, and that's an example of your superego. And I also say TMS stands for too many shoulds. You just should yourself all day. So like TMS is going to happen because you just too many shoulds today. So that's probably the first 3 months, you know, just sort of identifying TMS principles in real life. And then the action phase would be the, if this was like training, it would be like, it's not a linear process. It's, you know, 2 steps forward, 1 step back. And I would say it's not about each session is better than the previous session. What's most important to look at is the episodes that happen. So during that time, because we're getting into deeper psychological stuff and more emotional things are coming out, and so the body works harder to give you a TMS distraction. So like in Divided Mind, I think one of the rheumatologists says, you know you're succeeding in TMS if your pain moves around. Because, you know, if the therapy is doing its job, you're talking about things that your TMS was trying to cover up in the first place.
Yep.
So then it's going to move to another area to say, hey, go see another doctor for this part. So that's why that would be like the middle part. And then the end part would be sort of, you kind of got the hang of, you already been through so many failures. It's almost like you dieted so many times and then you knew, hey, you know what? I can have sort of an injury, but I always bounce back. I had an injury, or I had a wedding to go to, or whatever it was, where you threw off your training. But you rebounded enough times, I would say, that you're now you're not afraid of when TMS moves to a different place or when TMS happens again. So that's where I would say that's sort of the termination stage, where the fear is gone. And you're essentially just learning how to be a TMS therapist to yourself. So that's sort of like a rough timeline of like first, second, third stages of therapy.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, the last part about like sort of being your own therapist and not having the fear anymore. Because I get asked by other athletes that have certain things pop up. Even my buddy Pete, like he recently has had some personal stuff go on. And essentially like I don't want to give away too much, but basically he's had this hip problem for as long as I've known him, like 4 or 5 years. And recently there were some changes in his life and the hip pain and the back pain went away, or it moved around. Like that's the first time that he's had that kind of thing. And I was like, you got to read one of these books. And so it's been really interesting. And I get asked about like overuse injuries, and like I squat, you know, 3-4 times a week a lot of times. And what do I do if I feel a twinge in my knee? And usually I just tell people, like, you know, to be honest, like, I've had quote unquote tendonitis before. And I'm like, if I feel a twinge, I'll take a couple of days off. But I think of it as it's TMS, because even if it were something that, you know, were structural, I feel like I would start to feel it let off the gas after a few days. Like I'll still take the necessary time and things like that, because I injuries can happen, something catastrophic. But one of the things that I learned, this is from the Brooklyn Nets doctor, once had told me, I had asked him after my shoulder injury when I had surgery and I went through all this and I was still having pain in my upper back and my neck and stuff like this. And I had tweeted him and I said, what are the odds of a re-tear on a labrum repair? And he said, you would need something really catastrophic to happen to cause basically a physical injury. And so the concept that somebody can destroy their back by reaching into a crib and picking up their kid or unloading the dishwasher, right? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. I mean, these are my bodybuilding patients that I would say, oh yeah, you're squatting 5 plates and the 40 pound wood chip bag made you go out. Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about that.
One of the
in all seriousness, it's obviously because there's great fear because the bag has gone out before. So it gets very scary.
Yeah. I mean, a fairly like famous story on this podcast is the time that I, my back, like, you know, I was training for a competition. I was lifting a lot, and I reached down and picked up my 2-year-old shoe, and my neck spasmed, my back locked up, and all this kind of stuff. Like, how just stupid and absurd it sounds now when I look back on it. You know what I mean? 2 years later. You know, it's just one of those things, I guess. Okay, so I want to get to the question. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like what you're talking about, that would be like the middle stage of the treatment. And that sometimes is the longest part of the treatment, because it's like rebounding, like it's like having a training failure a bajillion times before, you know, the ultimate season opens or game day, because you just have to get used to picking yourself back up and saying, okay, I picked up wood chips. I picked up my 2-year-old shoe. Obviously, I had something else going on that I was so wound up to begin with. Right. And after you kind of get used to that, like after I would say like 100 rebounds, you kind of got the hang of it. And so I would say that's always the hardest part of the TMS therapy, is the failures or the episodes that happen in the middle.
I think that one of the questions might even bring that up, and it might even be from a patient of yours. Okay, we'll see. All right, so I'll run through some of these. We don't have to get super in-depth on the answers, because I know I've already kept you 50 minutes, and I know it's late on the East Coast as we record this. Dr. Chan is doing this at 10:30 at night, local time for her, by the way, in case anybody's curious.
I have a late start. I have a late start in the morning.
Yeah. So, okay, so this is from Justin. Justin says he listens to all the shows, and I've actually talked to him quite a bit, but he wanted to know, we touched on it earlier, but let's just do kind of a quick recap for him. The impact childhood trauma and abuse and abandonment early on has in developing chronic pain and depression later in life.
His question is, does it have an impact later in life?
He wants to know what the impact of childhood trauma and abuse and abandonment early on have in developing chronic pain and depression.
I mean, in terms of chronic pain, it's a distraction from seeing some of those unfinished needs that weren't met from early childhood abandonment and trauma. So I would say the impact of that, it's like walking through life with constant landmines, and you don't know where those landmines came from, and you don't know how to resolve it. So say like a soldier from, you know, war, they don't go into trauma zone when they were in the war, it's post-trauma. So the impact of that type of childhood is like post-trauma. It shows up later when you're finally in a safe relationship or in a good enough relationship, and somebody might slight you ever so minorly or doesn't seem to be a big deal, and you have this like full-blown emotional or TMS reaction. So that would be the impact of that. It was like say someone seemingly threatened abandonment but not really, and then the body goes into either a TMS episode, or that person goes into a emotional alarmist response, such as like annihilation or say emotional manipulation, or you know, depressive episodes, or you know, at worst, suicidal harm.
What about, so this one's from Chris. He asks, at what point should a decision be made to see a TMS therapist?
When you've seen enough doctors, and you've gone through all the workbooks, and you did all the, you've had about like 5 or more self-help books, and you read Dr. Sarno's book about like 3-5 times over, and your pain isn't going anywhere. Yeah, that's probably overdue, because it's really hard to look at the unconscious mind by yourself. The whole point of having TMS is that's like the most crafty defense mechanism your body produced, so that you don't see those unpleasant unconscious or emotional conflicts.
Yeah, and then somebody else had commented. I think this is more of a hello, but Barb, who's also in this group, and I'm pretty tight with her, and I met her because of TMS. She says that she's been a patient of yours coming up on 1 year. So I think that's more of a wave.
Hi, Barb.
So from Christina, what do you do if you have had a rough childhood but can't actually recall what the memory is? How do you journal it or discuss the emotions around events that you know occurred but you don't remember the details?
Oh, I always say that I'm not in the business of recovering lost childhood trauma memories because, hey, if your mind successfully repressed those and you just can't remember it, then it's best to keep that in that way. However, that doesn't mean that your body doesn't remember. So with those type of situations, I would say, let's just look at your current relationships because the landmines are there. How do you feel when your boyfriend touches you or when your mother-in-law says something? There's always another person in the present life that kind of shows, yeah, something, the way you respond to them is indicative of how you probably responded when you were a child or whatever the emotional reaction may be.
It reminds me
of just stick to present relationships and looking at the sort of landmines or repetitive patterns there.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. This one is from This is another patient of yours. Her name's Jessica. She says, I'm thankfully a patient of Dr. Chan.
Hi, Jessica.
Okay, James. So this is a good one. I said I would come to this one, and we sort of talked about it. So this is from James. He says, can you please ask her about how to process less specific past childhood issues? The real traumatic stuff is obvious, but what if you had a normal, happy childhood with great parents and don't recall anything traumatic growing up? My issues are dealing with self-imposed pressures as a child to succeed, and which has led me to a perfectionist type of a personality. He says that he just started seeing Dr. Is it Gwodz? G-W-O-Z-D-Z? You brought up earlier.
Oh, yeah. So Dr. Gwodz is the TMS physician of New Jersey. Okay. So Ira Rashbaum is a NYU physician after Dr. Sarno. Dr. Gwodz is the New Jersey TMS physician.
Okay. So James is somewhat local to you because he said he just started seeing him. So, yeah, okay. He fits in the category of, less – there's not – specific childhood issues. He had a normal, happy childhood and it self-imposed pressures. So what about those people? I know we talked about it earlier, but maybe sum it up
right.
Again.
That's kind of like that sort of the question or the topic we were talking about before is what if your A score is like a 1 and yet you're having TMS galore? So how do you process that? It would be to look at what basic need did your as good enough as they were, what basic need did they just not meet? And every child is different. You know, you have children of your own. Some are just needier than others. Some are more sensitive. Some are more intuitive. Some children needed more physical affection. Some children don't want to be touched. Some needed more, wanted a huge stage presence. That would be the last thing they wanted in terms of recognition. So in terms of processing it, I would say looking at self-compassion to say, what was the need you've always wanted? It's almost like a learning style that your parent just didn't get, you know, like what sitting in class wasn't the learning style you wanted. And what they kept doing as a good parent, they kept taking you to school, but that didn't really help with your learning style. So with someone who is perfectionistic, the parent probably, it's not the parent's fault, just didn't realize that they needed a different approach and meeting their emotional needs. And so that process would look at my parents did the best they could that way, but they had no ability of, let's say, take physical affection, for example. This child really needed physical affection, but the parent gave verbal praise. So we'll sort of talk about, okay, so good enough on the verbal praise, but what you really ultimately wanted was physical affection, or you needed special sort of recognition or opportunities to do X, Y, Z. And so that's looking at their original nature and having them see themselves first and foremost, and helping them be the parent they've always wanted for themselves.
Roxana's from Eastern Europe. She says, I had a really good childhood according to Eastern European standards, but my parents loved me dearly, but I was always supposed to be the best at school. I had to look the best. My nails always had to be done. My hair always had to be done. I had to be the perfect silhouette. I didn't realize the pressure until I couldn't keep up with this. So how can I deal with these things according to my values and culture, which are deeply rooted?
So sometimes I would say that there's like a teenager in all of us. It's almost like we have an imaginary audience that you think everybody's looking at you and they really care about your looks. And oftentimes I get creative with my patients and I would say, let's do an experiment. Why don't you go about your day with no makeup on? Why don't you go to the grocery store? And that would be like, you know, very anxiety provoking. So I might pick a more, whatever the least anxiety-provoking situation may be. So this is maybe sort of a more behavioral approach, but sometimes I say, I just need to collect some data points. So I would say, let's see how you feel when you go into a supermarket without makeup or not looking your best. Let's take some extra data points. Did a cashier notice? Did a friend notice? Did anybody say anything to you? So we might sort of gather some evidence and to see if you know, people really cared, and then find out, you know, people don't care. It's you've internalized this. And so we start to, you know, come up with situations where the person can be praised when they're less perfect or less, whatever, like that before Roxana, less appearance sort of perfect.
Helen and Lisa asked the same question. I can't even believe I'm asking this, but they have both said it seems like there's a lot of curiosity here about menopausal symptoms and TMS. So I'm going to let you run with that because I haven't heard that before.
Like vaginal dryness, hot flashes, mood, things like that. So menopausal symptoms and TMS. Yeah, I guess there's a lot of those questions, and I'm glad they're asking it. You know, kudos to them. It's a much needed question. So much of that, I think, yes, there's always TMS there is something physiologically, neurologically, hormonally happening. There is something happening. However, mind-body connection, just like there is a will to live and there's like a will to die, when I think of menopausal you know, situations, and I know that was sort of a broad, I don't know which menopausal they're talking about, but if someone stated that to me in that term, I would almost sort of ask, what's going on with the sexual libido? What's happening there? And we haven't talked about that part, but I would say so much of TMS, I would say, in terms of looking at the id, is looking at someone's sexual appetite, which is a barometer for id health. And so when I look at menopausal symptoms or, say, men with, we're living in the world of like Cialis and what's the other one?
Viagra.
Thank you, Viagra. And it's like, oh, where's that for women? And it's such a shameful, embarrassing topic to talk about, but it's intrinsic in all of us. So I would say that it's a valid question in TMS land. I can't just dismiss menopausal symptoms as purely hormonal. This is what happens when you age, so deal with it. I definitely would look at what were the emotional needs that were not met that would have increased sexual libido? What decreased? What turned you off? What turned you on? So despite menopausal symptoms, what are aspects that you may have noticed where it may not seem like you're having, or the situations or emotional situations that might occur where the menopausal symptoms were the least? So just like with TMS, how come sometimes the pain shows up here and why did it move over here the next time? So same thing with menopausal. If I start asking questions and find out that some days the menopausal symptoms are way more severe than other days, I'm going to fish for TMS at that point.
I have never read that or seen that, that there's a connection between like libido and the, did you say the health of the id? Is that the terminology?
So you're talking about women's sort of vaginal health. So we're talking about like interstitial cystitis, and for men, prostatitis or pelvic floor pain. You're talking about that whole world. Times where they experience that and times where they don't. And everybody comes from different cultures and sort of their sort of comfort level in talking about sex, religious backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, and sort of their level of taboo or, I don't know, sort of right and wrong for that. And so that's a pretty big part of the TMS therapy, is to talk about someone's sort of sexual development.
All right, we're down to our last two. So from Denise, Denise wanted to know, what is the definition of trauma? What is traumatic to one may not be to another. What resources are out there to educate new parents on the effects of early childhood trauma? And how can we prevent ourselves from creating trauma as a parent?
Wow, that's a loaded question. That's a lot. So let me break that question down.
So the first one was, what is the definition of trauma? Because what's traumatic to one might not be to another.
So trauma in the psych world is sort of defined as any event or situation or that has overwhelmed someone's senses, where they have lost power or they have felt violated, and they were not in control of their environment, their safety, and they had no control of it. So that could happen in a single incident, or that can happen in multiple chronic incidences. So that would sort of be a definition for trauma. And then her other part of that was...
Like resources where they can, like new parents can find out about the effects of childhood trauma, books or some kind of resources.
Yeah, there is so many resources on childhood trauma. Vandercook, Bruce...
Lipton?
No, Bruce... I'm just blanking out. I'm sorry. It's getting late here on the East Coast. There is a whole childhood trauma network, if she wanted to sort of Google that, that is a huge resource for childhood trauma, looking at how to help the child have a narrative. So we talk about alexithymia in children. Sometimes the child is young. They don't have words for it. But yet sometimes I find kids might have better words than adults. They might say, this scared me, or my heart was beating really fast. They're pretty good at describing if, say, the trauma was acute. The trauma becomes chronic, then you're talking about a child that is, like, dissociated. Now they no longer have words for their feelings, then you start doing play therapy or narrative therapy, so they can sort of use their play characters using their dolls or their action figurines. You take them to a pediatrician or a psychologist, and they sort of get that trauma narrative out of them. Either way, that trauma has to be processed verbally or through play. So through play, let's say the child can't really talk, it's almost like you have a bad nightmare, and you would say to the child, well, that was a really bad nightmare. That didn't end well. Why don't you show me a play that would be an alternate ending to what actually happened? And that sort of resolves some of the trauma. And they would do that over and over again, sort of this sort of almost kind of an exposure to help with the child. Like usually with children, I don't get too wrapped up in the unconscious stuff. I sort of have them do more of the behavioral hands-on and have them finish that business through play or through verbalization.
Awesome. Okay, last one. This one's from Peter. Can you ask her some ways to help children emotionally express themselves instead of repressing emotions?
I'm sorry, you have to repeat that question again?
So ways to help children emotionally express themselves, like, you know, as parents or aunts and uncles, like how can we help our kids better emotionally express themselves?
So with kids, I mean, depending on their age, I like to ask, you know, what, like happy, mad, sad. Those would be like the three simple things, three simple emotions. So, I mean, I shouldn't say they're simple. They're hard for adults. Like the difference between mad and sad sometimes. That movie Inside Out, if you are a parent, if you haven't, so you can see I'm a big movie reference person. So Inside Out is like Pixar. Do you even know what I'm talking about?
I loved Inside Out. I watched about 6 months ago and it just blew my mind. I thought it was awesome.
Yeah. So I always say that, you know, with kids, there's no such thing as a, I say this to adults, there's no such thing as a bad emotion. They're just signals. And one good healthy way to foster, say, emotional intelligence is, what are you happy, mad, sad about? And then to foster, you know, interpersonal emotional intelligence would be like, what's Bobby mad, sad, or happy about? And then the child will say, and then the parent might say, let's say this is another sibling, well, let's ask Bobby. Bobby, is that true? Did you feel that that was what you were sad or mad about? And Bobby might say, well, actually, what I was really mad about was this. So then when you have that discrepancy and you have that dialogue, now we have accuracy. So I don't know if that, I mean, there are many ways of doing that, but I would say if sort of that daily dinner table conversation, yep, breakfast conversation would be something like, you know, what are you happy, mad, sad about? And be careful not to lean one way or another, you know, not just ask what you're happy about. It's important to ask what you're, you know, sad and mad about too.
Yeah, no, I love it. All right. Well, that concludes. Thanks so much for taking some of the questions, and thanks so much for joining the show today. Where can people find you? You know, what? How can someone work with you if they really, really liked what it was that you had to talk about? You know, tell us all the good stuff. Where can we find you? How can people work with you?
Yeah, so I'm on my, you know, website, just drmargaretchan.com. You can definitely visit that website and email me from there.
Awesome.
And then I will, you know, call and respond.
Excellent. Thanks again so much, Dr. Chan. It was awesome getting to interview and learn a little bit more about you and learn your excellent taste in TV and movies. So, yeah, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.